The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 470 of the Columbia Calling podcast. Thank you to all of those of you who've sent in kind words of support this week for the podcast. It really has been quite special. And indeed, for those of you suggesting people to interview or recommendations, we do pursue these. We do read every email. So thank you again. This week's episode, episode 470, we take a look at a book by a rookie author, Colombian rookie author. Her name is Lorena Salazar Masso. She's from Medellin and the Chocó, so she grew up in both places. Her first book is called This Wound Full of Fish. I was sent a press copy of it. And we interview Annie McDermott, who is the literary translator of the book. And I tell you, this book is really quite something. I know there's been some, you know, interesting comments written about it online, but I'm just taking it from my perspective, knowing about Colombia, looking at the literature about Colombia, and I think it's a really quite a powerful book. So you can get it on Amazon. I've seen it there. This Wound Full of Fish. It did come out in English on the 11th of May, so there's no excuse at all. Anyway, debut novelist, really revealing something of an overlooked area in the Chocó up the Atrato River. Well worth reading, in my opinion. So do look it up. We have put the link to Amazon to the book in the show notes, so you will find it there if you are interested, but I do recommend it. Annie McDermott has done an incredible job in translating this book because, I mean, she knows Colombia, but so she's able to put it into context and a certain language which really does express, well, Colombia. That's the real deal here. Exciting news as well. My little private, well, say boutique editorial publishing house, Fuller Vigil. Well, we've got three books. We've got three books on the burner. And hopefully in the autumn, so only in a few months' time, we'll have all three of them out as a triumvirate. So we've got one based in Nariño, another based up on the coast, and one based in the Eje Cafetero, the coffee zone. All three are memoirs from very different perspectives. Political, agricultural, social, you name it. Very different. But the idea of this editorial is to get more books in English about Colombia out there so we can get a bit more understanding. And one of the tales is a tale of a child. So there you go. So there's a child. There's, of course, my book in Mompos, and then there's a book by a guy called Barry Max Wills about him on his coffee farm. And then we should be having with Dr. Andre Gomez Suarez. Look him up. He's an expert on all things peace related, and it's his upbringing in Nariño and the political, I would say, privilege, but not as you'd expect, but the political privilege that he was brought up in. So very interesting indeed. I'm working hard to get these out together in the autumn. So we're looking at September, October time. But, you know, they've all been edited. It's just a question of moving forward. So thank you again for your support, because this helps all us push it along the way. Now we'll go over to some messages from our sponsors, and then we'll come back with the news segment with the Columbia News Brief from Emily Hart, and then back with Annie McDermott discussing the translation and how she felt translating this book by Lorena Sanchez Masso called This Wound Full of Fish. Of course, if you want to support us directly, that's www.patreon.com/Columbia Calling. And we are grateful to everyone who signed up to this. Thank you again, and please don't go away. The Columbia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. We are also sponsored by BNB Columbia Tours, which is a leading tour operator providing a wonderful range of exclusive small group shared tours for those over 50, along with customizable private tours to both popular and off-the-map destinations throughout this beautiful and diverse country. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a unique private package of your own, just complete the form on the Columbia Calling website, that's www.columbiacalling.co, or the BNB Columbia Tours website, that's www.bnbcolombia.com, and they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all of your questions and to start the planning of your exclusive Colombian adventure. So that's bnbcolombia.com and latinnews.com. Thank you for supporting our sponsors.
I'm Emily Hart, and these are your top stories for the week of May 22nd, 2023. Crisis this week for the peace process with the ELN, the Ejército de Liberación Nacional, a guerrilla group formed in the 1960s, which is now Colombia's oldest insurgent group, currently in peace talks with the government in Havana, Cuba. Adding to existing tension and accusations of non-compliance with ceasefires, President Gustavo Petro announced this week that the ELN are no longer an insurgent group, fighting instead for territory for the illicit economy. The group responded by saying that his statement calls into question the entire negotiation. Talks paused before resuming last week. Meanwhile, FARC dissident group the Estado Mayor Central, led by Iván Mordisco, has announced it is evaluating whether or not to continue with the ceasefire with the Colombian state after a number of alleged violations by the armed forces. Former paramilitary leader Salvatore Mancuso has been giving evidence at the Special Peace Tribunal, the JEP, about alliances between officials, civilians, security forces and the paramilitaries. Mancuso was second in command of the Autodefensas Unidas de Colombia, known as the AUC. Mancuso has now given numerous names of military and police officers and claimed that the Colombian State Security Service, the DAS, provided the paramilitary with information in order to assassinate politicians, including an order for the assassination of now-President Petro. He has also testified that high-profile murders and massacres directly involved and were even ordered by local government and military. He has testified to links between paramilitaries and FEDEGAN, the ranching federation, and interference with elections of presidents, including Andrés Pastrana and Álvaro Uribe. Numerous businesses, including Drummond, Ecopetrol, Postobón, Chiquita Fruit Brands, and Coca-Cola, are also accused of financing paramilitary groups. Mancuso is at the JEP, hoping to maintain judicial benefits, i.e. reduce sentences in Colombia, for his numerous crimes during the conflict, including more than 800 massacres. To do so, he will have to have been deemed to make extraordinary contributions to the truth. He is currently serving a sentence for drug trafficking in a U.S. prison, from which he testified, having been extradited in 2008. As a result of his testimony, Colombia and Venezuela will start joint operations to look for missing persons on the border, as, according to Mancuso, hundreds of bodies were moved over the border and left in mass graves in Venezuela. He also testified that crematorian ovens were used to hide bodies of those killed by the military, as the high number of deaths were affecting officer promotions. Deforestation is dropping in Colombia, according to the government. Logging fell by nearly 10% between 2021 and 2022. This is a reverse in a trend over the last few years as deforestation spiked after the peace accord was signed with the FARC in 2016. The greatest improvements have been seen in the Amazon region. Airline Avianca has abandoned its planned merger with Viva Air, and Viva will be forced to close operations. The closure, as well as the recent closure of Ultra Air, threatens crisis for tourism in destinations like San Andres and Cartagena during this peak season. Together, those two airlines had 25% of the national market. Some predict domestic prices will increase as a result of reduced supply. Those were your top stories for this week. Thanks for listening.
And we're back. This is episode 470 of the Columbia Calling podcast. As I mentioned in segment one, our very special guest this week. So I sent back, and I guess we found out that Lorena's English is not, you know, up. She didn't feel confident about it. But I said, well, let's talk to Annie, the translator. And latterly, they said, Frankie, there in that office, said she knows the podcast. So that puts you in great stead and a great standing with me. And I understand that in 2019, you spent 3 months in Colombia.
Yeah, I did. In the summer to autumn of 2019, I was traveling around, and that was when I started listening to Colombia Calling as a way of both learning about the country and distracting myself from the very treacherous long bus journeys that I was taking about the place. And so, yeah, I started listening to the podcast then.
So you were pre-pandemic as well, and Colombia was booming. I mean, that summer, that period, it was our best ever period in tourism. And I also am going to get her out there. She did not stay in my hotel in Mompox. So that, you know, knocks her a little bit on the standings. But at the same time, she was in Mompox and she traveled around. And I can tell you that since 2019, the roads are still treacherous. The landslides are still occurring. And the accessibility does not appear to have improved because we've had a lot of cancellations of airlines and flights and so on. So even that side of things has worsened, which kind of takes us to the book a bit, because we addressed in this book this wound of fish. It's based in Chocó, and accessibility is of a key element all the way through, because you've got to get to Quibdó, and Quibdó is the first location in the book. But you didn't make it to Chocó because, again, accessibility and cost.
Yeah, it was a tough decision. I found it very kind of fascinating, the very idea of this region of Colombia that was so inaccessible and that has such a particular culture, which is so it's a region where there's a lot of the Afro-Colombian population lives, but also a lot of indigenous culture in this kind of amazing melting pot, which makes it sound completely fascinating. And we thought very hard about whether we'd be able to make it, but it just seemed quite a lot too difficult and also slightly dangerous at that time. We shared a taxi with a enthusiastic fisherman who said that he often goes to Chocó to go on big fishing trips, and that he'd stopped recently because the violence had been increasing around the summer of 2019. So that kind of...
Yeah, it was an issue. It's an issue because that river, well, of course, part of it, the accessibility of the department means that it's almost, there's no state presence in a lot of it, just in sort of the main cities and the main, and then you've got the Atrato River, which is dealt with in the book. It's the, amongst some people, is known as like the cocaine superhighway that runs up to Urabá and out. And so therefore it's very strategic for the armed groups. And in that vacuum that took place after 2016 and the peace accords, there's a jostle for complete power between the ELN, so the second, now the first guerrilla group, the National Liberation Army, and of course the Clan del Golfo, so sort of offshoot of the paramilitary groups, delinquents, criminal organization again. But so what is most exciting to me, Annie, is that you've been to Colombia and you have soaked up the atmosphere, and you've talked to people, obviously, who know the Chocó, and this has given you a background with which to approach. But perhaps it might have been a benefit knowing Colombia but not knowing the Chocó coming to the book, because the descriptions, they are very, I mean, they evoke Chocó very profoundly. And I think you must have had to have had, well, I go into this, how do I translate this to get it into that, the language, into that ambience? So, I mean, were you and Lorena very much in contact about this? When if she saw a translation, no, that's not the word. That's not what we're trying to say. How was your communication to describe Chocó? How did that come through?
So the communication, I was quite in touch with her, I guess, especially towards the end of the translation. Normally, as I work through a translation, I build up a ever lengthening list of questions to ask to ask the author. And so towards the end, I sent Lorena quite a long list of questions, which some of which were about quite particular kind of very Chocó specific terminology that even Google couldn't really help me out with. And then some of it was also maybe about the possibility of adding what translators call a kind of stealth gloss to the text. So if you want to kind of perhaps include a word in the original Spanish, or just include a word that people outside Colombia won't necessarily know what the meaning is, rather than including a footnote, for example, which is quite like, which translators aren't very into at the moment because it's quite unfashionable in the translation world to have too many footnotes. You might want to just include a kind of a few words in the text to give the reader a bit of a hint about what's going on.
That's interesting. So, in a literary book, I wouldn't want to see a footnote, fashion or not. In an academic book, a more academic, I'd have no issue with it. You know,
absolutely.
A political journal, I don't mind a footnote, footnotes, a long footnotes or index in the back. But this is literature. I would prefer not to have, an asterisk and then go down and see. So what is your stealth gloss? What did you have to look at?
I mean, there are so many different. So just trying to think, there's the the really silly one occurs to me, which is just the animal paca, for example, which that is the word in English as well. But I think if you said that to if you just included that, a English speaking reader might think it was just a misprint of an alpaca or something. So I have, where there's a paca in a cage, I have a furry white spotted paca in a cage, just to give like a bit of an image of what we're dealing with.
But I think that's fine. There was another animal, wasn't there, as well, that you translated, and I came across. I read it twice because I can't remember what it was. I should have noted it down, but I can't remember it once, and I was like, "What?"
So yeah,
I probably knew it better in Spanish than in English. But then that's
this is sometimes what happens. But yeah, lots of the food, lots of fruit, lots of vegetables, and then. Yeah, I forget exactly what I did, but quite a lot of the kind of, there was a kind of interesting balance to find in terms of what's unspoken in the book and what has to remain unspoken in relation to the armed conflict itself, because it would change the book completely to over explain that stuff in the translation. But at the same time, if what you want is for your readers to have a similar experience to people reading it in Spanish, you want them to sort of to pick up on the clues.
Yeah.
But you want them to still just be hints.
Well, I think that is one of the key points. It's what is not said in the book. And that's something that really, it's very evident all the way through. And I think it would be evident to a non-Columbia reader. I think so. It's that you don't, because I found myself not wanting so much to be explained, because as we can feel through the book, there is a rising tension. And if I'm not mistaken, the first several chapters, although there are, kind of large reflections to an earlier time in it, so it sort of reminds me a bit of François Mauriac a bit in that one. The book in question I'm thinking of is Thérèse d'Esquerou, but it goes back to the past to explain things. But again, it doesn't reveal too much. But the first few chapters are very much a canoe ride, a motorized canoe. And therefore, to me, it's a an embrace of the river as the environment, as everything. And that first chapter sets the scene between why the Atrato River is so different from, let's say, the Cauca or the Magdalena. And there's some descriptions in there saying, you know, the gray of the Atrato, I think it is, not like that. And immediately sets it apart, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing. Sometimes gray, sometimes cinnamon brown, I think.
Yeah. That for me was very special because you really were putting a distance between the rest of Colombia and this. And but I mean, you know, you've done so a dozen or so books, Spanish, Portuguese to English. How does this compare to others that you've done? I mean, how does this compare? Is there anything from a similar isolation, I would say?
Yeah, and I think it's sort of, I think one thing that really sets this book apart and what made me so interested in translating it is actually the prose itself. When I think about the way Lorena describes this river, describes this landscape, it's just so lush. It's so luscious, kind of in the way that vegetation is lush, her writing, kind of very like, very full, very abundant, very kind of, very sensuous, all these different tones of green, all these different kind of, yes, like sounds and smells, and all of these amazing images. The river's so kind of shape-shifting throughout this book, so it becomes an arm of black earth, it becomes a tiger that could swallow them whole at any moment, it becomes, like the title, a wound full of fish. It's so, and I think that's what makes the book really stand out, this very particular kind of, like this very particular identification of the prose with the landscape that it's describing. And I think that does, I feel like there are parallels to that in other books that I've translated, but maybe in an almost opposing way. Like I translate a fair few books by an Argentinian writer called Selva Almada, mm-hmm. whose books take place in this very, very dry, very dusty landscape in the north, in the Chaco, as opposed to the Chocó. And her prose is very, very sparse and very stripped back and very kind of like sort of, yeah, bound up in the landscape in a completely different way. So this feels like a kind of interesting counterpart to that, I think, as a translation project.
But I think, you know, if you've got a counterpart that's so extreme, that helps you, isn't it? It helps you, because the Chocó is total abundance. I mean, that's it, isn't it? It's and the earth provides, the river provides, and then the population provide. And that's one other thing. You notice that there is a kinship between the principal character, her son, and then, of course, just the people met on the motorized canoe. There is immediately a degree of, I wouldn't say amiability, and I wouldn't say it's for survival. There's just a different culture, and that was very impacting. So I think, you know, if I can say out loud here that three of the main sort of tenets of the book are identity, race, and place, would I be on point?
Yeah, I think these are all things that are completely central to the book. Yeah.
Oh, good. I'm glad, because in my English literature and French and Spanish literature courses at my undergrad have been worthwhile.
Yes, all those been years leading ago, up to this moment.
All those years ago. Now, how did you feel? I mean, you know, they start in Quibdó, and there is really the description of a frontier city. And Quibdó does have that chaos, and it is a frontier city, and it has the culture of San Pacho and San Paulo. And, you know, there's this descriptions of the port and the brothels, you know, not opening their doors at a certain hour and so on. But it's just like, the whole town is a port. I mean, the whole town is defined by the river. And what I found very interesting, again, is the absence, I mean, they're there, suggested, but there is an absence of male characters. The principal ones, or the ones mainly written about, are women. So, I mean, can you delve into that a little bit?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting an interesting sort of thing about this book, the fact that I guess there are two sides to it, to the kind of centrality of the female characters. And one is a kind of a deliberate choice on the part of Lorena that to place her focus upon kind of women and the lives of women during this time in Colombian history, during a conflict, kind of what it's like getting on with the everyday business of living when there's an armed conflict going on around you. So what it's like kind of cooking the meals, raising children, kind of, you know, watching the children while they play in the street, making sure they come back in before dark, all this kind of, just this kind of, this side of life, which I think she's making a very particular decision to focus on in the book and to give a different perspective on this period of Colombia's history. But then I think also it's at points in the book, it's a simple reflection of how life was. So when she reaches Bellavista and she's spending time with her adopted son's biological mother, and they're talking about what's happened to her other children, and her male children have been taken off by armed groups, and that's the end of that. Like, there's also a reason why women are so central to this book, and it's because the men are elsewhere, whether or not they want to be.
And I think this is one of the big conversations taking place, is that, you know, some of the principal victims of the armed conflict are of course women, the ones who are left to maintain the home, the children, the income, the food, and so on, or left alone at the end. And without going into that more, I think that is a very key, because it does seem like there are women, and then that tragedy of Rossi, Rossi, who is pregnant on the boat and loses the child, and then, you know, obviously has bleeds out from lack of real medical attention. And it's just, I feel, and I think that you had to, obviously, you had to explore this as well in the translation. A loss of life is a very, I wouldn't say mundane, but it's very ever present in the region and in the book. But it's not, there are two periods in the book which are particularly shocking. One is Rossi, the other is towards the end, but we're not going to talk about it because you all have to read the book. One is at the end, and yet those feel impacting, but death is a constant, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a constant presence, and it just, I mean, I think, again, without speaking too much about the ending, which should definitely not be kind of revealed to people who haven't read the book, I think a real difference between, maybe a real difference in the experience for Colombian readers of this book and readers in the UK or in the US is this relationship with death. Like, I think there's, even when I was reading it, I found myself thinking, oh, this is really brutal. This is really awful. This is almost too much. And then when you read about the history of Colombia, you think, no, this is everyday reality. This isn't at all over the top. This is a reflection rather than a kind of melodramatic reconstruction of it. So I think I find that quite an interesting reminder that just the texture of, the texture of these things is so different.
I think you're right. And that, I mean, it's so ordinary, I would say, along it, and its impact. You know, and again, the friend in the town saying, "Oh yeah, you know, well, the friend, the birth mother saying, well, no, they were taken off. The men took them, and then they were killed trying to escape." And you're just like, and that's it. There's no tears. There's no. There are no words of sympathy. There's no conversation. It's not developed in that way. It's almost matter of fact.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there's something there's just this constant sense that, yeah, I think matter of fact is right, that you have to kind of get on with the business of living as well.
And I think while it is a genuinely Choco-centric book, I do think that kind of thing could be transposed anywhere in Colombia. A small town in the Montes de Maria, up in Cordoba or in the Cauca or where else. I think that is one of the elements, isn't it, that could be. I mean, when you traveled around, did you get into any areas which you thought, oh, they've really suffered here?
Absolutely. I mean, that's something that's really present in so much of Colombia. I mean, the conflicts sort of in the very recent past and also not entirely really concluded. So I think you're really aware of that the whole time. And just, I have very vivid memories of standing in all sorts of different places in Colombia, looking at the jungle and just thinking how it would have seemed. It's not just kind of, oh, the natural world, this place that's so separate, but a place that's so full of kind of hidden forces and kind of people and goings on, and just how sinister and unknown this kind of landscape that surrounds the places that you live would have seemed. Mm. Like, which I think is something that's really present throughout the book as they're driving, as they're sailing down the sailing down the river and just looking at what looks like sort of trees and undergrowth and vegetation, but knowing that it's not just that out of sight, within that there's so much going on that they're constantly vulnerable to and that they're constantly kind of, enthralled to without even being able to see it. And I think,
I think that really, you're light on that. The word sinister is very good because it's not something overwhelmingly discussed here. This issue of being sinister and the forces, and we're not talking about armed forces. I think we're talking about a certain mysticism that includes the conflict, but also includes the natural world. When you say sinister, and we're looking at what could be a paradise, and there is that point where they stop. I think they stop, is it, to go and try and get some food, and yet the quote is, "No, there's nothing here. Those people took the food in a shop in the middle of nowhere. You know, a riverside dock." Basically, and it's like, no, those people took it, and then that's it again. So you end up, if I'm not mistaken, rereading those points just to remind yourself of what's going on. But you said something about driving, and there is driving at some point in the book. And I wanted to read a quote, and later on you'll read us an excerpt from the book so people can get a style. But I wanted to read you a quote there's a couple that impacted me, and one was, "We're no longer so squashed in the back of this red willies, which is lopsided like the smile of a lonely old man." And it's wow, you know, the willies are the World War II era jeeps that are used all over Colombia for the 4x4s, and they're totally indestructible. And if anyone's seen any sort of tourism pamphlets, there'll be a willies on it, you know, maybe a red one with bananas and coffee and whatever else stacked on top. But to have described it as lopsided like the smile of a lonely old man seemed so unusual, but then so correct at the same time. Are there moments then when you get to something like that and translate it and you stop and you smile?
Absolutely. Like that's, and it's moments like that that are just a gift if you're a translator, because it just sort of sounds so amazing in English as well without you even really necessarily having to kind of think too much about it. And I think there's something, this book's so full of moments like that, partly because it's a book which is so permeated by the kind of the child's world view, both of her son when she's seeing the world, both as she sees it and as he sees it, and when she's kind of all along this journey, she's having to make up games to entertain him or find ways of explaining what's happening that will make sense to him without frightening him or being too honest. But also, and then there's also her kind of flashbacks to when she's a child. And so all through this, as you say, very sinister book, there's a kind of parallel view or vision of the world around, which is kind of childlike in that kind of, not necessarily innocent or but just that kind of childlike logic where you make slightly different connections to the connections made by an adult, or where you're kind of just operating on a slightly, where you have different priorities, different things that are interesting to you. Like the names of the plums that you're eating yes. might be more interesting to you than sort of, you know, any armed men sailing by. So I think there's that childlike view.
She does create a shield, doesn't she, for him? But she doesn't, I wouldn't say she doesn't sugarcoat it. There is a shield, but at the same time, it's like he's still young, but there is a reality here. And, you know, there's that quote as well. And I'll get to that. I'll read the quote here. I've got it. And we go back to Rossi a bit. And I wondered how she would explain, or would she just kind of ignore the reference to Rossi dying? Would she tell her son? And I think she doesn't tell him, because I think it's an internal commentary where she says, meeting Rossi just before she died makes her a part of my future, even though she's no longer here. Maybe I'll visit her with some real flowers when I get back to Kibdo. And I think that was internally said, wasn't it?
Yeah. So that's not actually said to the boy, but then he does know what's happened, but you kind of realize that he knows what's happened at that slightly like both sad and amazing moment where the day after, the morning after the morning after her funeral, the vigil, there's music and the boy suddenly starts dancing and he's just having this amazing time dancing. And the woman's thinking, I didn't teach him how to dance like that. How did he learn this? And then in the end, after this kind of real like cathartic scene of sort of movement and music, he lies down in the middle of the floor where Rossi's body had been the night before. And he says, Ma, I'm dead from dancing so much. So he's saying it and he knows it's happened, but as a kind of joke, or is not, it's sort of on what level has he taken it in, or how is he processing it? It's kind of exactly what I mean about this kind of parallel child's eye view of what's going on, because he is processing it, he's taking it in, he's thinking about it, but just not in the same way as the adult characters are.
And then there's that force as well of the earth and being connected to it, and again it comes back, it's through everything. But before we get a little bit further on, there's one other thing that I wanted to discuss, just jumping around a bit, and I think it's a Colombian thing, and I wanted to know if it's something that you experienced or you felt that it's a Colombian thing. Is that the conversation between let's say the main character and then the new friend on the boat, it's intrusive in my mind. You know, I again, Northern European, would prefer not to share all of my private workings in my family, but of course, you know, there's an intrusive nature of the questions, and I just think that the private is very much in the public domain. And how would you, after your experiences in Colombia, do you feel that this is something that runs through the country, or is it something that says what's more, it's more based in that region or elsewhere?
Yeah, it's a tough question. I mean, in the context of the book, I think it's fascinating because of kind of what this boat ride become, or this boat ride makes it sound so frivolous, but what this boat journey becomes. It's such a kind of microcosm of the kind of like this image of this group of people who are just trying to like get where they need to go, and they're just going on this single journey in this down this river that's just one aim, which is just get to the end of the journey. And yet there are all of these different kind of potential risks and dangers lurking on either side. And I think that's it feels like such a kind of metaphor for just what it feels like to be trying to just get through, get by. And I think that then the world of the boat somehow becomes their whole lives sort of begin to take place around each other. Like privacy does become different because everybody can hear each other's conversations. Everyone becomes part of all of the different kind of health things that happen to each other, or all the different conversations, all these different things, all the kind of, if you're singing, everyone's listening, like somehow it's such a shared experience that I think privacy does become something a bit different. And it starts to feel quite like, I think early on in her sort of friendship, and this is an example of what you're talking about, because it does kind of become a friendship between the protagonist and Carmen Emilia, the woman sitting next to her. But early on, it does feel quite surprising and maybe intrusive and just quite bold the way she's asking these direct questions. But really quickly, it starts to make perfect sense. And it just seems like the most natural thing in the world, because just, I think boundaries are different when you're in that sort of situation.
I think so. And I think, again, there's that connection through everything. And it makes me think, the very first time I traveled to Mompos, the bus broke down. Surprise, surprise. And I was the sole foreigner visitor on the bus, and everybody wanted to talk. And, you know, we were standing in the sunlight, not a tree to offer shade, not a tienda. There's always a tienda somewhere where you can buy a drink from. At this point, there wasn't. And, you know, the people started making sort of funny declarations nearby to therefore, I guess, break down the barriers to talk with me. Yeah, so I heard one guy further up in the bus, sort of four or five rows away, the gringos can put a man on the moon and we can't even get a bus tire down there. And you knew that this was a way of bringing the conversation in and including me. So I thought, and by the end of it, they knew who I was, what I was doing, how much family I had, and everything else. I mean, that was it. It was that interesting thing. So, you know, everyone is in that same situation. I'm not going to say everyone's in that same boat. Everyone's in that same situation. So before we get to you reading an extract, I just want to say, you know, to the listeners out there, it's an incredibly powerful book. It can be read in one sitting. It must have been a very difficult book to translate, to get the nuances, because there are the nuances. And when I talk about the nuances, it's like we've mentioned that the sort of, not the absence, but the sort of, I not isolation either, but there's an absence. They're not completely absent, men. They are there. The suggestion of them are there. And of course, it's very much they are the armed conflict, and there are references like the red bandana and the black boots, and then a reference like the man in green and red in a speedboat, or the Gina's sons being taken by the guerrilla, and then gunshots in the distance. It's a long way off yet, and that kind of things. You get those, and if you're not watching for those, you could miss them. But that's part of the idea as well. And I think that makes it quite powerful on that level. There's one further reference, and then we'll get into your extract, Annie. They do stay at the Encanto Hostel. Did Lorena have artistic license and try and make the comparison with the famous Disney movie?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I feel like definitely some license in the naming of the Encanto Hostel, but I don't even know of the famous Disney movie with the
Encanto. Oh, wow. Well, I have not watched it. My sons have watched it several times, but it's all about the mysticism of Colombia. It's a Disney movie and it brings it out. And actually, the conflict is suggested in it as well. But at the same time, there's a magical realism to it. And it's the film's called Encanto. And I just maybe, she's suggesting a counterweight to that kind of almost idealized Disney movie to this wound full of fish. But I don't know, maybe that's my license. Maybe I'm being overwhelmingly pretentious. Maybe there is an Encanto Hostel in that region. Who knows? I mean, because I know that Lorena Salazar grew up in Quibdó. She has to have known the river. She has to have known these towns. And much of this must be drawn from, from memory, of course. You know, you base a lot of this on what's going on. So, I mean, I'll leave it to you, readers, whether you want it to be a reference to the Disney movie or not. Please don't let me lighten the nature of this book. So, Annie, you're going to read us a short extract as we bring this to a close. What have you chosen from your translation to read?
Okay, so I'm going to read from the opening. I'm going to read the very beginning and then just jump forwards a little bit. till when they're boarding the boat, just to kind of give a sense of the river and a sense of the relationship between this woman and her son.
Perfect.
And the sense of this sort of luscious prose. Okay, this is from the beginning of the book. The boy and I arrive at the dock in Quibdó. We're looking for a canoe that will take us both, plus the soft toy penguin he's been carrying since we left home, to Bella Vista. We sit on the concrete steps that lead to the Atrato River. I buy him a mango with lime and salt from a woman nearby, and we wait. Mornings belong to the birds. They sing from the trees along the bank, even the youngest with nests of bald-headed chicks, starving and defenseless. "Look, Ma, a birdie," he says. "It's not a birdie, it's a vulture," I tell him, my mouth full of mango. The turkey vulture perches on a rubbish bag. I don't want to explain to the boy the difference between that ominous creature and a birdie, and he doesn't ask. The animal takes flight, and the current sweeps the bag down the river. The town begins on the river's right bank and spreads into a jungle that makes it pay, resisting the invasion and reclaiming its space by filling the walls with damp and mould. In Quibdó, the Atrato smells of saltfish, oranges and wet wood. Cutting deep through the land, watched over by rickety old houses, kept company by women and children who wash clothes on its bank. This is the river in its infancy. It's born in Carmen de Atrato and meets its end in the Caribbean Sea. The townspeople live off it, fishing, sailing along it and singing, or praying to its waters. A thick, fleshy arm of black earth. And then I'm just going to skip forward a little bit to when the woman and her son are boarding the canoe. The captain looks at him and tells him to jump, that there's no need to be scared, that she'll catch him. I take hold of the lime-shaped charm at my neck and kiss it. As soon as he sees me, the boy knows he can jump. That charm is a sign he invented one night, completely sure of himself. Ma, whenever you have the line between your teeth, it means you're saying yes to everything. Children make unbreakable rules. As for me, I submit to his law. In return, I ask him to do his homework before going out to play, preparing him for a life full of trade-offs. We educate each other. I teach him to become, and he helps me to come undone, to live in new ways, following signs nobody else would understand. He's with me. I didn't give birth to him. I'm his mother and I always will be, however far he strays. That's what I tell myself every night in a prayer to let him go. As we stand facing the canoe, I want to tell him not to jump, that we'll go home instead and switch on the TV, that I need him. I smile and his right hand lets go of my dress, leaving it covered in creases. A one, and a two, and a three, he yells. Then leaps, and the captain catches him. Your turn, Ma. Jump onto the boat or plunge into the current. The boy thinks I'm about to jump onto the boat. He sounds happy, festive. It's a game. The shadow of jumping is plunging headlong, an act of complete surrender. I plunge headlong, pretending I'm just jumping, and the boy hugs me like when he comes home from school. I smooth his shirt with my hands and we sit on the wooden bench the captain points us towards. It's white with no backrest. If this were a tiny aeroplane, I'd say we were in seats 2B and 2C. The captain steers from the back. Unlike the times when we've travelled by plane, neither she nor her helper, a young guy who's just jumped onto the canoe himself, seem surprised that my son is black and I'm white. There you go.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And that sets the scene as well for everybody to go out and buy the book. I imagine it's available in all good bookstores and, of course, online at the usual places. Annie, if there are people out here who are looking to have things translated, how can they get in touch with you? Do you have a website?
How can they? I actually don't have a website, which is absurd. They can... They can
Twitter?
Email me. Okay. No, I'm on Twitter.
Okay, so what's your Twitter handle?
It's Annie L M C D.
MCD. There you go. Annie L M C D. I can't promise you future work, but maybe, just maybe, someone out there will go, wow, you know, future things have happened, I think. Let me take this moment to say thank you so much. You've really captured a lot of things, and you've taken me back as well to the days of when I had to do literary criticism at university. And so for that, it was really enjoyable. And you've given us a little bit of an insight in what it's like to translate, because it's not an easy job trying to get someone else's words across into another language.
Yeah, it's true. It's fascinating and difficult and a lot of fun and very satisfying every time. It never gets old speaking to somebody who's read a book that I've translated and actually sort of experienced it the way I was hoping someone would. So thank you as well.
Really nice. I enjoyed it. I will read it again, more, you know, and take more time. I obviously read it very rapidly, but rapidly and hopefully got the gist of things and so on. But I can genuinely recommend it out there. I mean, if I didn't like it, I wouldn't recommend it. That's the truth. So do check out the new book by it's her debut novel, isn't it? Lorena.
It is, yeah. Salas and she's Adamasso. Very young. She's younger than me, which is always unfortunate for a translator.
Which means she's younger than me, and everyone's younger than me now. So yes. Do check it out. This Wound Full of Fish by Lorena Salazar Masso. And of course, you can find it in Spanish, but of course, you can find it in English online. Let me take this moment to say thank you so much to Annie McDermott for taking the time out of her day in the south of France. Very nice. Hopefully this brings you back to listening to the podcast once again. I know you're not in Colombia, but hopefully this will entice you to listen to the podcast and maybe return to Colombia in the future.
Definitely.
Thank you very much for listening. We'll go over and have some messages from our sponsors. But at the same time, if you feel that this is worthwhile, please take a look at our Patreon page. That's www.patreon.com/Columbia Calling. And you can leave, what amounts to a tip or a little bit more for the Columbia Calling podcast and help us maintain, viability. But anyway, this has been episode 470. Now over to some messages from our sponsors. Thank you very much for listening, everyone, and bye-bye. The Columbia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. We are also sponsored by BNB Colombia Tours, which is a leading tour operator providing a wonderful range of exclusive small group shared tours for those over 50, along with customizable private tours to both popular and off-the-map destinations throughout this beautiful and diverse country. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a unique private package of your own, just complete the form on the Columbia Calling website, that's www.columbiacalling.co, or the BNB Colombia Tours website, that's www.bnbcolombia.com, and they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all of your questions and to start the planning of your exclusive Colombian adventure. So that's bnbcolombia.com and latinnews.com. Thank you for supporting our sponsors.